Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to Murder Mile, a true crime podcast, an audio-guided walk, featuring many of London's untold, unsolved, and long-forgotten murders, all set within and beyond the West End. Today's episode is about James Forbes McCallum, a desperate man whose first and only robbery was ill-judged, unplanned, and such a catastrophic failure that it ended in death. And yet, when he was arrested, he was so panicked that he gave the police 5 plausible alibis. But which alibi was right? Murder Mile is researched using the original police files. It contains moments of satire, shock, and grisly details. And as a dramatization of the real events, it may also feature loud and realistic sounds, so that no matter where you listen to this podcast, you'll feel like you're actually there. My name is Michael, I am your tour guide, and this is Murder Mile. Episode 102, The 5 Alibis of James Forbes McCallum. Today, I'm standing on Wellington Street in Covent Garden, WC2. One street west of the brutal baker Alexander Moyer. Two streets northwest of the last days of Marianne Moriarty. A short walk from the home of the first date killer. And barely 100 feet south of the former Bow Street Magistrates Court, where an infamous forensic scientist would categorically prove, without a single shred of doubt, that Dr. Hawley Crippen had murdered his wife. Only he hadn't. Coming soon to Murder Mile. East of Covent Garden is Wellington Street, a thin, one-way street from the Strand to Bow Street, which is home to the Royal Opera House, the Lyceum Theatre, and a wide variety of restaurants, cafes, bars and pubs. And although there's also a museum, being British, the most important places are the pubs. We celebrate everything in pubs, whether births or deaths, commemorations or condolences, weekdays, weekends, and for those who don't work hard enough, bank holidays. Like most places, Wellington Street has many watering holes. Some are hideous hipster hovels serving Hoxton's finest ale in tiny thimbles. Some are brewery-owned dumps slopping out factory-produced drinks and nibbles to dull patrons who are allergic to imagination. And some are unashamedly fake boozers, where the decor of Guinness signs, old bikes, potatoes and cheeky leprechauns is so culturally insensitive, they might as well have just added some burnt-out cars, some kiddie-fiddling priests, and insisted that the band wears orange sashes. As the Polish bar staff all utter,
"Ah, to be sure,"
as the St. Patrick's Day crowd flock to celebrate a world-famous teetotaler by swigging back a mouthful of de black stuff.
De black stuff.
Only to grimace, struggle to swallow, and dilute the rest of it with blackcurrant.
Ah, Jesus.
Thankfully, at 42 Wellington Street is a real pub. Established in 1753, the Coach and Horses is a staple of Covent Garden life. With its red-fronted facade, greenery above, a left door leading to the public bar, and a right door to the saloon. This free house is authentic, real, and hospitable. It's a great place for a pint. But 80 years ago, it was also the scene of an unplanned robbery and an unexpected murder. As it was here, on Friday the 20th of December 1940, that a good and decent man called James Forbes McCallum would be driven by a desperate decision to steal money and take a life. James Forbes McCallum, known to his pals as Jimmy, was born on the 20th of September 1920 in Dalmuir, Scotland, a few miles north of the bustling shipyard city of Glasgow. With his father working as a steel riveter in the docks, being recently married, with one boy born, and a second soon to join their brood, his mother worked several jobs just to keep this tumble-down tenement over their heads. Known only as Mrs. McCallum, his mother was a short but solid woman made of sturdy Celtic stock, who toiled away from dusk till dawn with one boy on her knee and one strapped to her chest. For the first few years of his life, James's whole world revolved around his mother. When she wasn't there, he screamed. But when she returned, he was soothed. As a neat and decent woman, seeing poverty as no excuse not to raise her boys well, they all knew their P's and Q's, their manners and morals, and although she was undoubtedly hard-working, she was also a little haughty. Contrasted by her rough, calloused hands, she wore a fine hat, a neat shawl, she spoke with an upper-class affection, and to everyone, even her own sons, she was Mrs. McCallum. On the 1st of December 1922, desperate to flee their grimy Glasgow slum, the McCallums set sail to Canada, having arrived in New Brunswick just 3 days before Christmas, and set up a new home in Quebec. As a slightly sickly, intensely pale child, having taken the bold but wise decision to raise her boys in the crisp, fresh Canadian air, although, for the rest of his life, James would be thin, frail, weak, and prone to every cold and infection, his chance of survival was 10 times better than in Glasgow. Being an average student, James was decent, likeable, but unremarkable. He didn't excel, but then he was never in any trouble. And raised well by Mrs. McCallum, after school and every weekend, James earned a small wage as an errand boy, half of which he always gave to his mother to earn his keep. In 1931, when James was 11, his father died, leaving his mother a widower with no income. Being industrious, she turned their home at 391 3rd Avenue into a boarding house, aided by her sons. But by his teens, living and working day and night alongside such a controlling woman, James felt trapped. He had no future, no fun, and under the harsh scrutiny of his disapproving mother, no girlfriend. Mrs. McCallum wasn't mean, she was just scared. As once her boys had grown up, she knew that she would be left with nothing. In 1938, having become unwell, she shut the boarding house. This was James's chance to escape. And yet, it was a world-changing event which would provide him with freedom.
This country is at war with Germany.
On the 5th of September 1939, with Europe at war against the Nazis, 18-year-old James did his bit and signed up to fight as part of the Royal Canadian Regiment. Barely passing his medical, as a 5'8", skinny and pasty-faced boy who would never see the battlefield, as part of the Canadian Provost Corps, he was assigned to protect London as the city's own police force had been decimated. Starting as a private, within the year, he was promoted to acting corporal on a wage of $80 a month, $50 of which he sent to his mother in his regular letters. Described by his seniors as a sober, respected, and an excellent officer, he rarely drank and was never in any trouble. And as a welcome sight, being dressed in the easily identifiable uniform of the Canadian Provost Corps, a peaked cap with a bright red top and a long grey greatcoat with a bright red emblem, being armed with a .455 caliber Smith & Wesson revolver and based out of nearby 30 Henrietta Street, James and his fellow officers were a familiar and reassuring sight as they patrolled the streets in and around Covent Garden Market. Just one street from the Coach and Horses pub. James Forbes McCallum was well-mannered, polite, and decent. He had a good career, a steady income, and a bright future ahead. He didn't argue or fight, and he had no criminal record or history of violence. And yet, 15 months after his arrival in England, in a totally unprovoked and spontaneous attack, he would commit an armed robbery and a murder. In a state of panic, as his terrified brain fumbled to find an ounce of logic in his truly abhorrent actions, James gave the police 5 logical but equally plausible alibis as to why he did what he did. Alibi 1. Drink. Most crimes are committed while the culprit is intoxicated, causing a lack of judgment, coordination, and a misguided confidence. James wasn't much of a drinker, but in the weeks, and especially the days leading up to the incident, his best friend, 44-year-old Lance Corporal John Osborne, known as Mac, said that James had begun drinking heavily, just as he had the night before the robbery. If he was intoxicated, that could explain why his memory was so hazy, why he shouted, "Hands up, paper money," but he didn't steal a penny, why he hid his face with a thick woolen balaclava, but forgot about his long grey greatcoat, emblazoned with a bright red emblem of the Canadian Provost Corps, and more bafflingly, how James got shot in the arm when he was the only person in the pub with a gun. And yet, if the barman had fought back, as James would later suggest, why did no one hear a fight? Where were the fingerprints if the barman had wrestled away the weapon? And how could two men have struggled together if there was a bulky set of brass and glass screens between them? That aside, we know that James wasn't drunk, as having got his dates wrong, he'd actually drank with Mac 2 nights earlier, barely drinking the night before, and when he was arrested, he was stone cold sober. Alibi 2. Money. Many crimes are perpetrated for financial gain, as too often, greed and needs can overrule a person's morals and even make the most sensible do silly and spontaneous things. Sadly, a few weeks after his promotion to acting corporal, being declared physically unwell, James was demoted to Lance Corporal. If he was broke, that could explain why he robbed the pub, why he felt forced to loan 10 shillings off Mac just 2 days prior, why, as a good boy, he only sent $25 to subsidise his sick mother in November, and why, by the 14th of December, just 1 week before, those regular payments would cease. And yet, it seems unlikely, as James wasn't a greedy man. If anything, he was generous and charitable. And as a Lance Corporal, he still made a good wage. And with his clothes, his food, and his accommodation all paid for by the military, for those 3 weeks prior, he was living in a modest double room at the Trafalgar Hotel, just off Trafalgar Square. Alibi 3. Illness. As witnessed 32 years earlier, in the bank of Cartmel and Schlitt, just half a mile west of Covent Garden, a long history of illness and the weakened immune system of a sickly young boy had possibly triggered petit mal seizures, under the grip of which a young man had robbed a bank, but could recall nothing. Always being pale, weak and frail, having moved from the crisp air of Canada to the choking smog of London, James's health had deteriorated. 1 year prior, being struck down with pneumonia and pleurisy, the army doctor had assessed James 4 times over the last 4 months, and being declared unfit, he was forced to take unpaid leave, and he was demoted owing to his poor health. If he was ill, that could explain the robbery, the shooting, the vagueness of the incident without being drunk, and how a good man could be driven to heinously break his own moral codes. And yet, even that seems a stretch, as James had no history of epilepsy or any mental illness. He was never aggressive, delusional, or disorientated. Being fit to stand trial, he didn't take the insanity plea, and although his memory was a little vague, he pleaded not guilty to murder, as he knew the barman, he liked him, and the two men had never had any issues. So the question wasn't if he had consciously done it. He had. The question was why. Alibi 4. Trauma. The human body is a marvel of self-repair. Skin can heal, blood can clot, and bones can mend. But the hardest injury to recover from after an incident isn't any physical effects, but the psychological ones. As although the brain may escape unscathed from an unimaginable horror, trauma can still remain. On Friday the 11th of October 1940, at 12:35 a.m., 3 days into the Blitz, a high explosive bomb hit 24 Greek Street in Soho. It demolished the building, erupted the gas main, and trapped dozens in the wreckage. 3 people died, 8 people were injured, and countless others escaped unhurt, but were left traumatized by this first brutal wave of bombings from the skies, as innocent civilians, going about their everyday lives, witnessed skin burned, limbs scattered, and bodies blown apart, right in front of their eyes. One of those affected was James McCallum. Being psychologically traumatized by the bombing, seeing the army doctor, and complaining of a series of justifiable symptoms, such as tiredness, headaches, and nerves, James drank to ease his pain, took sick leave on the 16th of December, and was recuperating well in the quiet of room 6 in the Trafalgar Hotel. And yet, it was unlikely that his trauma resulted in either the robbery or the murder, as the personality, behaviour, morals, and the attitude of James had not changed. Those who knew him said he was still his same old self, quiet, calm, caring, keen to get back to work, and was making a slow but steady recovery. Without doubt, all 4 alibis had contributed to the crime. Money had made him desperate, drink had clouded his judgment, illness had made him weak, and trauma had fueled his fragmented emotions. But these weren't the main motivations for his crime, as his 5th alibi was love. Strangely, having first met on the night of Friday the 11th of October 1940, the bomb, which had blasted Greek Street apart, had ignited a passion inside a passing couple and driven these 2 young lovers together. Swept up in a whirlwind romance, as wartime sweethearts, 21-year-old James McCallum had fallen for 19-year-old Irene Turnbull, a local waitress and recent orphan. As a perfect match, both were quiet, shy, and caring. and just as she was his first love, he was hers. In just 9 weeks, they had met, fallen in love, moved into a hotel together, and just 1 week before Christmas, they planned to be married. James had finally met the one. Only there was one obstacle ahead of him, his mother. Mrs. McCallum would never approve of this girl, or any girl, as no girl would ever be good enough for her little boy. And as she had always feared, once he was gone, this lonely widow would be all alone. On Monday the 16th of December 1940, having slipped the best ring he could afford onto his beloved's finger, James and Irene got engaged in the shadow of Trafalgar Square, with their plan to be together forever. On Tuesday the 17th, having drank until he was insensible and being in a distressed state, James poured out his woes to Mac, his best friend and a surrogate father figure who he always turned to for help, as having telegrammed his mother to get permission to marry, he anxiously awaited her reply. On Wednesday the 18th, the day of their wedding, James received a telegram. It read, "Ridiculous idea. Seems very thoughtless to me. I need your help." And it was signed, Mrs. McCallum. The young lovers were distraught. Their wedding was cancelled, and the money they'd saved to marry was gone. On Thursday the 19th, with his heart ripped apart by the gut-wrenching decision between disobeying his mother or finally finding love, although Irene was happy to wait, a furious James fired back a telegram to Canada. "With a curt, I shall marry, with your permission or not." That night, having prematurely signed into the Trafalgar Hotel as Mr. and Mrs. McCallum, the two timid lovers lay in bed, curled up in each other's arms. Only James couldn't rest. After months of illness, days without sleep, still half hungover, and another night of reawakened trauma as the bombers pummeled the West End, having loaned 10 shillings off Mac, he knew this still wasn't enough money to get married. At 4 a.m., James left the hotel, saying he was going to buy some cigarettes. But instead, he did the unthinkable. The Coach and Horses at 42 Wellington Street had long been a family business. Owned by Daisy and Harry Phillips, the pub was managed by their nephew David Shulman, with his brother Morris as the barman. Described as a sweet and kind man, 40-year-old Morris, known as Morrie, had only worked in the pub for the last 9 months, having lost his job to the war. And although he wasn't outgoing, the customers liked him, as he was a good man who loved his wife, his family, and he kept to himself. Set on the ground floor of a four-story red brick building, most of its regular customers would perch with a pint on the pavement, as this small single-roomed pub was barely 20 foot wide by 25 feet deep. Dominated by a large central bar, the room was split into two, with a larger public bar to the left and separated by a partition, a small saloon to the right, which stands 20 people at a push. With lines of tap handles for pulling pints, spirit bottles with upticks, water jugs as mixers, and a tea urn for the lightweights, it was very much a regular pub. And as a way to serve food, and to act as a security measure which kept any drunks from the booze, the bar staff, and the till, above the counter, from waist height to head height, were a set of brass and glass grills with a series of spring-loaded windows. With a license to serve from 5 a.m, having put a £20 float in the till, Morris opened the doors, and the day started as it always did. slowly. At 5:10 a.m., 54-year-old John Anderson, a short one-armed lift operator, entered the public bar, ordered a pint, and sat reading the paper. He was the only customer. David was in the cellar. Dolly, Murray's wife, was upstairs. And Morris was cleaning the glasses. But less than 1 minute later, Morris would be dead. As James staggered up Wellington Street, with his mind clouded by equal measures of love and anger, and his body stumbling with exhaustion, as this lovesick boy could only see one solution to his problem, without his mother's permission, he would be forced to commit his first and only crime. Only being ill-judged and unplanned, this spontaneous robbery would end in a catastrophic failure. Outside the pub, James's terrified fingers nervously pulled his woolen balaclava over his pale face. His breathing was fast and frantic. His head was thumping hard. And having forgotten that his long grey greatcoat was emblazoned with the bright red emblem of the Canadian police, fumbling his army-issue revolver in his cold, sweaty hands, James dashed into the empty saloon, intent on a quick robbery. Inside, James stammered, "Hands up! Paper money!" Only his order didn't make any sense, as with the pub having only just opened, the till was full of coins. And yet, amidst the darkness of this sparsely lit pub, with a bulky brass grill in their way, the two men couldn't see each other. So although Morris had put his hands up and his eyes shut, in the hope that this would all go away, as James couldn't tell if he had seen the gun, he swung open the glass of the head-height serving hatch and poked his gun through. Only, not realizing that the window was spring-loaded, the second his left hand let go, it swung back, the glass smacked the muzzle, and flipping his revolver 90 degrees, James shot himself in the arm. The bungling bandit was dazed, confused, and profusely bleeding from a self-inflicted flesh wound. The robbery was a catastrophe, and right then, he should have fled. But with his nerves frayed, his body tense, and his hot balaclava riding up his sweat-soaked face, with the eye holes obscuring any view, he hadn't realized his mistake, and thinking that the unarmed Morris had shot him, James retaliated. A single shot ripped through Morris's throat, hitting the hard bone of his spine. The bullet then fractured into three pieces. One hit a glass panel, one hit a picture, and one hit the tea urn. But the bulk of the lead had severed the barman's spine. And before he had even hit the floor, Morris was dead. Being too panicked and traumatized by his actions, James fled empty-handed. Shaken up, James called Mac, who rushed back to the billet they shared at 2 Bedford Place. And reassured by James that this was nothing serious, he had just accidentally shot himself. Having dressed his wound with a field dressing and iodine, the two pals parted company. At 8 a.m., hearing a bulletin, the detectives were seeking a young Canadian police officer in a long grey greatcoat with a bullet wound to his left arm. As Mac was a professional, he called it in. At 9:30 a.m., James was arrested for the murder of Morris Shulman. In a state of panic, confusion, and exhaustion, being desperate to aid the police with their investigation, although his memory of this traumatic event was a little hazy, James gave 5 possible but equally plausible alibis for his crime. James Forbes McCallum was tried at the Old Bailey on Tuesday the 11th of February 1941. And after just a two-day trial, he was found guilty and sentenced to death. On Friday the 28th of February 1941, a few days before his execution, Mrs. McCallum died. Being distraught at the grief of losing his beloved mother, James won his appeal on compassionate grounds and owing to the trauma he had suffered in the bombing. And with his execution commuted to a life sentence in prison, James was deported back to Canada to serve the rest of his time. James Forbes McCallum was denied love by his mother, marriage to his lover, and being short of just a few pounds for a very simple wedding, he would be forced to pay the ultimate price. James never married Irene, and being separated by a vast ocean, the two young lovers would never meet ever again. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for listening to Murder Mile. That was the episode, and next is Extra Mile, the non-compulsory extra bit which you can choose to listen to or choose not to listen to. I'm good either way. It's no biggie if you don't. Before that, a big thank you to my new Patreon supporters, who are Kelly Cook, Caroline King, Neil and Sharon Waugh, happy belated birthday Sharon, and Seanette Jones. I thank you. All of you will be receiving a thank you card full of goodies, and some very lucky people will receive a very rare Murder Mile keyring too. Ooh. Murder Mile was researched, written and performed by myself, with the main musical themes written and performed by Eric Stein and John Books of Cult With No Name. Thank you for listening, and sleep well.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Yay! Done and dusted. Ah, and rest. Open windows. Let some air in. Let some flies in, which seems to be the thing at the moment. That's the problem with being near a poo plant, is there's lots of flies buzzing around. There's a big ones, and every time I sit down to have a cup of tea, I grab my tea and I go, oh, there's a big old fly on my tea, having a good old sniff, walking round on my cup with his feet all covered in shit. Ah, oh, lovely. Anyway, everyone, hey, this is Extra Mile. We are here. We're back. We're back with Extra Mile. This is the extra bit, as mentioned, not compulsory. You don't have to listen to this bit. The episode was the bit you just listened to. This is the extra bit. You can switch off now if you want to. It's not a problem at all. Yes. No, I thought I swatted a fly. It wasn't. It was my earplugs. Same colour. Right. I'm going to make my tea. I'm going to grab a cake. I'm going to swat some flies. I'm going to open some windows because it's bloody hot. I'm going to let
all the flies in. They're probably queuing up outside. Oh, there is an unnatural whiff around here. It's weird. You kind of get used to it. You kind of, when you first moor up, you go, oh, what's that smell? It's a weird smell. It's, you know, it's the smell of shit, but it's weird. It's I'm not too sure whether it's concentrated or diluted or what, but there's, yeah, very, very definite smell of plopskies. So, pop a tea bag in, pop me sugar in. There we go. That. Whoa, what to have as a treat? I'm gonna have two treats. Let's do it. Two treats. Wow, I'm really spoiling myself. I'm having a little Bakewell tart from Co-op. Oh, yes. I might have to eat that quick before the fly lands on it. And a penguin, a penguin. Lovely. Chocky Bickies. I think they're not too far from, I believe in other countries you have a similar thing called Tim Tams, which I've tried many times. They're very good. I think penguins are kind of our version. So now people are going to think I'm weird because I've just opened up my windows and doors, and now people are going past and going, well, there's a man talking to himself. That's fine, I don't care. Oh, right. Oh. So, what's been happening recently? I moved to a different place. It's nice and quiet here. Although the second I got out of my boat, me and my magic trainers, which seem to find shit wherever we seem to be, I was like, what's that? And I realised my first foot on soil was not soil. It was on big, in a big dog plop. So I spent about half an hour trying to clean away the dog plop. That was lovely. That was a treat. I picked up loads more Murder Mile mugs. As you can appreciate, I don't have my PO box is in town, and I'm about 30 miles away, so I had to cycle into town with coot fight outside, like three rucksacks on my bag, and I get into town. I filmed some of the location videos when I got into town, try and get as much done as possible in a short amount of time. Got in there, did all the videos, packed as many bags, rucksacks as I could with mugs and badges and stickers and the new key rings I picked up as well, which is very exciting. And then I had to carry them back, and it was a bloody hot day. Oh dear. So when you get your mugs and your treats and things like that, remember that they've traveled from one place to my PO box, but then I've cycled all the way in and put them on my rucksack, and I like to carry them back, and it's, oh, by the time I get back to the boat, I'm exhausted. Anyway, they're back, so I've got more mugs. So if anyone wants a mug, they're there. Some lucky patron people will be getting exclusive key rings. I don't know whether I'll sell them in the shop yet. I'm not too sure. Or whether they'll just be a special thing anyway. What else have we been doing? I had some Mrs. Crimble's macaroons recently. They were very good. Very good. I think I've mentioned those before, where I thought they were in the kind of the free from section, so I thought they were good and healthy. But then I realised on the back that each macaroon is about 250 calories. Yeah. So, yeah, easy way to get fat. Last week after I recorded, it was laundry day, as always. So I went to my new laundrette that I've never been to. And as you walk in there, instantly you see people wearing loads of PPE. They've got their visors on. They've got the, like, almost like full hazmat suits on. It's a bit disconcerting when you kind of, you know, you put your... You've got a big washing machine full of like pants and socks, and they're standing there looking at your washing machine wearing all this protective gear, and then they turn around and go, we just need to add some disinfectant, it's because of the virus. And you go, is it because of the virus, or is it because it's my pants and socks? Yeah, anyway, so there was that. I had a day off last Sunday. That was exciting. I don't normally have a day off. Normally it's Sunday is prep the next episode, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday is write, Thursday is record and clean up all the audio, Friday, Saturday is edit, then back to Sunday is put it online, do the blog, da da da, and get ready for the next episode. And I got myself a little bit ahead, and then the Sunday morning I woke up and I thought I can't be arsed. Another, it's like another 7 days of slogging my guts out. So I had a day off, which was very nice. I woke up, had a bacon sandwich, yep, very vegetarian of me. I watched What did I watch? I watched Dial M for Murder, because I like my Hitchcock films. Dial M for Murder, and then I watched North by Northwest. I was going to watch Foreign Correspondent, but I watched that instead. That was good. And then I went for a long walk, and that was really nice. That was good. Tea's up. So I think I'm going to have myself another day off this week, methinks. I think it was always a panic of having a day off, because it's like I'm used to working a little bit of like a chunk of Sunday and then all of Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday and Thursday, Friday, Saturday, or writing on those days. But because I took Sunday off, I thought, oh no, now I'm behind with this writing the story. But then I kind of realised, you know, I sat down on the Monday and I actually did a shit ton of work. And then Tuesday I did a shit ton of work as well. And I thought, and it wasn't really a struggle. And then I realised, you know, as I've said before, if you give yourself an extended amount of time, you'll use all that time. Whereas if you give yourself less time, you'll use all that time. And your brain's focused. So if you give yourself too much time, then I'm a daydreamer. I can drift off into a little dream world for hours and have fake conversations, which I love. But if you know you haven't got the time, you haven't got time for conversations. So, and I find myself going, Michael, concentrate, get back to the story. So it's been quite good. I've been powering through these stories. So I'm going to do that from now on. Give myself Sundays. I think I've said this before. Give myself time off. I never do, do I? But soon, probably the tours will start up again. So that'll be fun. That's a little. Well, I've got burpees. I've got real burpees today. Shouldn't have had 3 chunky fish finger sandwiches for breakfast. Oh dear, I've been burping all the way through this episode. Right, let's do the quiz questions. As mentioned, some will be in this episode. Some I might have edited out for time purposes or whatever. So I'll give you the questions now and then we'll do the answers later on. Right. Question 1. What were the 5 alibis of James McCallum? I did them in order. So what were the 5 alibis of James McCallum? Question 2. Which room did James stay in at the Trafalgar Hotel? I've taken pictures of all these locations. So the Trafalgar Hotel, 2 Bedford Place, which was his billets that he shared with... I'm making sure it's not a question. Mac, yeah. All these locations and the pub as well. So I'll put those on. That's on the Patreon page. They may be on my blog as well. I sometimes put things on my blog as well. Question 3. What did James's dad do as a job? Cool, you have to stretch your memory back for that one. Question 4. What crime was James previously convicted of? So before the murder and the robbery, what crime was he previously convicted of? Question 5. What was the name of Morris's wife and his brother? Briefly mentioned in there. Question 6. What type of gun did James carry? Same gun as last week as well. Although there were a lot of them... in the country at that point. Question 7. What was James's military rank when he was arrested? Question 8. What job did Irene do? I can't think about her name being Irene, because Irene is the code name they use in Black Hawk Down when they're going into war. And every time I write Irene, I go, fucking Irene! I might watch Black Hawk Down again. That's a good film. Question 9. Where did James and Irene get engaged? And question 10. Which building was blown up in Soho as witnessed by James? I've taken a picture of what it looks like now. That'll be... I think I put that on the blog because it's mine. I think the original photo... I'm not too sure because I probably won't have the copyright for that. So I don't know. I don't know where I'll put that. Interesting episode.
I heard about, I heard about it somewhere, this like years ago, about a man who went in to rob a place, and I think they said that like a serving hatch, they said he was drunk and he lifted it up and he shot himself and then shot someone else, and it sounded really shit, and I almost wasn't going to do this, but this was one of those episodes where I thought, let's go and read the file and see what you can get. And even though the hatch system on there is a little confused, and it's taken me a long time to try and make it sound right to you, so you can kind of visualize what it's like. I've got some crime scene photos, which I'll put them on the Patreon account. I might try and put one or two on social media, so you can have a look at it, because I think they're kind of interesting to have a look at. But they're a weird contraption, so it doesn't fully make sense. And they had modified it themselves, so you know. Even the police struggled with this kind of thing about how the hell did he shoot himself? But it makes for an interesting story. And actually, when I found out that he wasn't just a drunk man, as the press said, as I've said before, the press always pick an angle on this which is best suits their purpose. Instead, when you look at it, it's love, but it's also trauma, and you know, there's a lot going on with his mother. So I think that made it kind of interesting. He's kind of very different to other robbers. You'll also notice I deliberately put this episode immediately after the last week's episode, the one about the what was his name? John Esmond Murphy, the guy with the epileptic seizure that caused a robbery. Normally I wouldn't do that. Normally I wouldn't put two episodes that are so similar together. But there was a lot of correlation between kind of the John Esmond Murphy one, where he was committing a robbery, but he was in a kind of a state of trance because of his epilepsy. And whereas this one, I could kind of push it that way, but then to make you think, oh well, it's going to be the same story, because it's very similar in a multitude of ways. But when you actually get into it, it's kind of like, actually no, he's very conscious of what he's doing. It's just, you know, like a lot of people forced to make a really really rash and dangerous decision which he'll regret. There's also similarities here to, if you remember, the Richard Rhodes Henley episode, the randy Canadian sailor who came over to Soho. If you haven't listened to it, I think it's episode 16-ish. Came over, stole literally £7,000 worth of pornography, shot Alan, Big Al, who was the owner, to death. Should have been executed, but again, because he was a Canadian military soldier, couldn't remember the words then, he was pardoned from his death sentence and sent back to Canada to serve his full sentence. So there seems to be a lot of that going on, especially wartime. There's a lot of, like, if a soldier is going to be executed in Britain, then that government seems to go, no, we're not going to have that. You need to send them back and we'll pardon them. Anyway, I'm sure they did it the other way around as well. Just before the night, as mentioned, just before the night of the murder robbery, there was a heavy bombardment in the West End. Didn't mention this in the story, but Morris Shulman, his wife and their family, they weren't staying in the Coach and Horses pub. They lived above. They didn't stay there. They were actually staying in the basement of Page's on the corner of Wellington Street and York Street, as that is the nearest air raid shelter. I'm wondering if it's still there today. And hence, they were not too far away when they were able to open up that morning. Coach and Horses pub looks almost exactly as it did back then. It has changed very little. I haven't got any photos of inside, unfortunately. I've only got photos from the crime scene photos, which kind of help. But it has kind of... they've taken down the kind of brass and glass grills at the moment. They're not there. They went years ago. So, you know, I can't really show. And also, they've taken away the partition between both bars. So there's a little bit of changes on how it looked. We don't really mention much about Morris Shulman, the victim, here, because I wanted to do this as kind of James Forbes McCallum's story. But Morris Shulman, brother of David, who was the manager of the Coach and Horses. He was 41 years old, known as Murray. He was out of work at the time. He'd worked there full for about 9 months, but on and off for about 4 years. His wife was also the barmaid and worked in the kitchen. It was owned by their aunt and uncle. They didn't live there, the aunt and uncle. They lived at the Strand Palace Hotel. Ooh, very nice. Everyone seemed to like Morris, said he was sweet man, kind, quiet, kept to himself, had no enemies, liked to stay at home. He was just there because he needed the work, really. And as mentioned, you know, this pub was really picked at random by James McCallum. We know if you look at the map, you've got Covent Garden. Covent Garden Market is not big at all. You could walk across it in a minute and a half, 2 minutes. Wellington Street is on the eastern side. So it's the first road on the eastern side. And then as a spur road just on the western side, southwestern side, which if you listen to the Meander Mile for Covent Garden, you'll hear both on here. And Henrietta Street is a spur road on just on the western side. So it's from pub to the Canadian Provost Corps, where James worked, was maximum minute and a half, 2 minute walk. If that, you could almost, if there wasn't a building in the way, you could almost see it. So he would have known that pub. There's a lot of pubs in the area, but he would have known that pub. It's quite a popular pub. He didn't mention how many times, whether he'd been there that often, but it's very likely that he did. As mentioned on the morning, £20 in the float. All in coins. It was actually £14 in large silver, £2 in small silver, £4 in copper. Police said there were no notes in there, even though John Anderson, who was the one-armed lift operator, had a pint of ale there that morning. He'd either paid in coins, or he was told, that's fine, you don't need to pay on this one. Interestingly, there was, as mentioned, the pubs were open at 5 o'clock. Back in those days, pubs were licensed to open at 5 o'clock. But if you look at the photo, there's a big sign above that says, men in uniform of Her Majesty's Forces will not be served during 5 a.m. to 9 a.m. service. Although, interestingly, if you were working, you could go in and have like a morning pint. What's all that about? Like, for me, a pint is an evening thing. I know some people do. You see people walking to work and having a couple of pints on the way into work. I think that's wrong, because you know, if I have a pint in my brain, I know that my brain's not 100%, so I won't be as focused. So, but it's like people who you know, I used to have mates who used to get stoned before they go to work, and it's like, you're not going to be as focused, you're not going to be as sharp as you think you are. But then, you know, each to their own. Right, what else we got? Just walking before the robbery, so he'd left the Trafalgar Hotel. He'd left Irene there. He was walking down the Strand, so he can walk down the Strand. It's I would say it's probably a 3 or 4 minute walk from the Trafalgar Hotel on the edge of the Strand to the Wellington Street, the Coach and Horses pub. He was still in his full uniform. He was also wearing his what they call the forage cap. It's like a peak cap with a red top, a red kind of band on top. Obviously, because he's military, he has to wear that. But just before he went in, he popped on his service balaclava. Service balaclava was full and woolen. They were issued them as they were coming over on the boat because it was really cold. Obviously, going from Canada's cold anyway, but Britain's quite cold too. It was full woolen. It had eye holes and one for the mouth, so you could pretty much see nothing when he kind of came in. As mentioned, he hadn't slept. He was tired. He was exhausted. There'd been bombing the night before, so he was all over the shop. We don't really have much in the terms of witness statements. Obviously, we have Murray, but Murray's dead. James doesn't remember much because he was in a bit of a, you know, bit of a state after, as you would be, having, you know, being a nice person and then going off committing a robbery, and being a nice person and committing a murder, and even worse if you think about it, he's a policeman as well. He's a policeman still, probably technically on duty. Well, he wasn't. Well, he was on sick leave, but you know, he's still in his uniform. He's a policeman, and then he goes off and commits a robbery and a murder. So the state within his mind must have been absolute nightmare. Dorothy, the wife of Morris, she was upstairs at the time. She was literally coming down the stairs with two cups of tea, one for her, one for Morris. Actually, one for David, one for Morris. When she heard the two shots, she was frightened. She stood in the stairwell for about 2 minutes, trembling, and then she was like, then she came in to find out what was going on. She actually found one of the bullet casings sat on the bar, so I'll explain that shortly. I didn't mention her, but there was they had a maid called Julie O'Keefe. She was on the second floor. She only heard the shots. She didn't see what happened. David Shulman, who was the brother, was in the cellar at the time. That's where the safe was. But obviously no one went down to get money from the safe. He was just sorting out the beer for the day, making sure everything's good. So the only person who we have as a witness is John Anderson, so the one-armed lift operator. John Anderson said that about 5:15, a man came into the saloon bar. He was wearing a big army khaki. It says khaki. It was actually really grey colour. Don't forget, it's quite dark. It was a great coat. He says a large wooden woolen scarf wrapped around his face so he could only see the eyes, but it wasn't. It was actually the balaclava. This is the problem with witness statements, is the police will always say this. It's people always say, I'm 100% about this, but like visual memory is only about 30% accurate. And as things go over time, even like, you could get 10 people in a room. You could have one person walk into the room and go, hi, I'm looking for Bob. And then someone goes, oh, Bob's away, down the street. And the person leaves and they've been in the room for 10 seconds. And if like just half an hour later, you'd say to those people who aren't under any stress, what did that person look like? What was their height? What was their hair colour? What were they wearing? 10 people looking at the same person will all have a different description. Not massively different, like, oh, I thought it was a woman. But, you know, you'll get a height between 5'6" and 6 foot. You'll get, you know, between 10 stone and 15 stone, you know. What they were wearing will be different. People's visual memories are pretty bad, so that's why it can never be fully relied on. What else have we got? James came in. He said, hands up, paper money. John Anderson said the shots came almost on top of each other. They were pretty fast, so I'll explain that very shortly. It took the police quite a while to work out really what had happened, because although James has said there'd been a struggle, if you look at the pictures, there's no way for the two men to struggle. The brass and glass grills in the way just make it not possible. You've literally got maybe between waist height and maybe nipple height, maybe just below nipple height. You've got kind of a place there where you can put a pint through the counter, but above that, above your head, it's all a grill. So you can just about see the barman. You've got to probably, I remember them from years ago, you've got to pop your head down and kind of work your way around to see the person. So there's no way they could have fought. James said he couldn't remember if he was reaching for the cash register, but I've actually got maps of the layout of the pub, which I'll put on my Patreon account. The cash register's on the opposite side of the bar. So, you know, nothing seems to make sense. What does make sense is that Morris didn't do anything. Morris rightly just put his hands up and, you know, as he rightfully done. But the shots did pretty much come on top of each other. It's odd. I've tried many times to try and replicate it. The hatches are kind of spring loaded. They open up outwards. So if I'm James and at, let's say, collarbone height, let's say nipple height, because I like to say nipple, at nipple collarbone height, you've got kind of a little kind of drawer-like window in front of you, and that opens towards the bar. What would happen is the barman would open up their window, would put dinner plates on there so they could be served out, or we could go, oh mate, your fish and chips are ready, and then go, oh cheers gavler, can cut up, and then you can get the plate, and then the second you take the plate away, the spring closes the window, so the windows are always closed. But what it seems to be is that James with his left hand opened it with his left hand, poked his gun through, and then closed it. But it seems to, I don't know, it seems weird that it would have such a fast spring to be able to knock the gun away. It's weird when you look at it, the glass is smashed through. It obviously smashed really quickly. I don't know, the police are still, they were still trying to work out whether maybe he misfired, hit the glass, the bullet fragmented having hit the glass and then went into his arm. But given the fact that James's arm, the bullet hole through it was pretty clean, it was kind of in and out, it went through the ulnar bone. Do you know, they say it's more likely that the window deflected the muzzle of the gun, and then his gun was facing his arm as he was trying to keep the window open or close it, and then he shot himself. It's a weird one. It's hard to work out. But either way, what we do know is he did shoot himself. And immediately on top of that, maybe believing they say it was more than likely a reaction shot. He believed that he'd been shot at, so therefore he shot at Morris. And the shots came right on top of each other. So I've got a couple of crime scene photos on there, and the police have put little arrows on there, so you can see where all these shots came. So the first shot obviously hit the glass and then went into his own arm. The bullet for that was found on top of the counter by Dolly. The second shot, this was the reaction shot. As mentioned, Jones pulled out his gun. He fired it at Morris. It went through the left-hand side of his throat into... So he was probably slightly turned to the angle, then went through his spine. I think I've got the exact detail here. Oh, I forgot about this. This was this was the... if you follow me on social media, this was when I was in the archives ages ago. And right at the start of the case, John Anderson, I read his report, and he said, I turned round and there was a man and he had glitter on his left arm. And I thought, what a bloody stupid thing to say. Glitter. Bloody idiot. And I just... So I stayed in my head and I dismissed it. And it was only when I got to the end of... all of the research, and I was looking at this, and then I worked out what it was. The glitter, it wasn't glitter. He was saying that something was shimmering. It was actually the glass on the panel had smashed and had gone onto the onto his greatcoat. So that's what I see. For me, I think that's more likely. If there was a shattering of glass at that speed, I would think it's more likely to be a deflection off the glass into his hand. Hence all the glass, because it says on here that he had powder burns on his arm, so it was obviously at close range. I was sitting in the National Archives, and then all of a sudden I got it, and I went, glitter, at the top of my voice, and then everyone looked at me, and I had to apologise. But it was then that I understood what has happened. But even to this day, I still don't think we'll fully understand exactly what happened. It is pretty complicated. What else we got? Oh yeah, so the second bullet went through his spine, severed his spinal column. The bullet's fragmented. I've got pictures of it. One went into a tea urn. One cracked the top of a glass panel. Another hit a picture frame that was in there. What else was there? That was it. John Anderson, who was there, didn't mention this in the story, but John Anderson immediately ran out, went into the street, and on the corner of Russell Street and Catherine Street was PC Samuel Marchinski of the War Reserve. He said he didn't see the soldier or hear the shots, but he issued a description immediately when he heard John Anderson shouting, "Help, police, man shot." Interesting, he didn't say police murder, as everyone seems to be saying at the moment in these stories. He went in and he said Morris was by the time he got in there, he was dead already. Right, what else we got? David Shulman, obviously his brother, came up from downstairs. He heard the two shots, came up, saw his brother with an injury to the throat, rushed to his brother's side. But yeah, by that point, he saw that his brother was already dead. Interesting, when you look at the doctor's report, the doctor says, doctor turned up about an hour later and said, oh, the man had been dead for about 30 to 40 minutes. But everyone else said he was dead literally by the time they got there. Horrible smell of shit has come over again. Dr. Alexander Baldy, the police divisional surgeon, arrived at 6:15, so that's an hour later. Well done, doctor. Said Morris was lying on the floor in situ, his left arm flexed, his right arm extended, a wound to the neck below the left jaw, very small amount of blood, because obviously it went through his spine, which meant there was no brain function going from the brain down to any parts of the body, which meant he couldn't breathe, which meant his heart wouldn't be working, which meant he had no blood circulation. So same as Christine Grenville in that story when she was stabbed in the heart. Obviously, you know, killed instantly, you don't get any bleeding because the blood's not pumping. Therefore, you know, you'll get a little bit of seepage, but that's it. Little bit of seepage. Autopsy conducted by Sir Bernard Spilsbury. Bullet entered. What else did he say? Passing through his full cervical vertebrae, shattering the spinal cord. Cause of death was injury to spinal cord. No shit. What else did we get? Oh yeah, okay, so we didn't do this because obviously the Canadian Police headquarters was at 30 Henrietta Street, one street away. About half an hour after the incident, Sergeant Stewart of the Canadian Military Police got a call from James asking to speak to John, who's obviously Mac, his best buddy, asking to see him. He said, it's imperative I speak to him. He said that James was really crying and really upset. So even though Mac was on duty, Mac managed to get a call through to him. They agreed to meet at the junction of Southampton Row and Bloomsbury Square, which was just by Two Bedford Place, which was their billet. Mac said, anything wrong? Has someone been knocking you about? Because James looked in a really bad state. He said, no, it's worse than that. I've shot myself. Mac said, left arm. And noticed that his left arm was inside his jacket. At that point, he was wearing his forage cap. Obviously not the balaclava, because that would look weird. They went back to their room at Two Bedford Place. Removed his coat. Mac got out some hot water, some iodine, the field kit, dressed his wound, looked at it. You know, it wasn't bleeding much. It was fine. It was in there that James left the revolver and the bullets, the shells that he'd used. And from there, he went back to the hotel where he would eventually be arrested. So let me just do this bit. Okay. Detective Inspector Capstick, who was assigned to the scene, got there, and he was obviously, John Anderson had said, the guy who came in here was wearing a Canadian military uniform. He got a red emblem on the on his arm, and he'd been shot in the left arm. So DI Capstick immediately just walked round to 30 Henrietta Street and said, we're looking for a guy, Canadian, military police uniform, shot in the left arm. They put out a report. Interestingly, Mac was, because he was on duty that night, he was escorting an officer who was absent without leave back to Waterloo Station when a description of the murder and the suspect was mentioned. Mac put those pieces together. He was like, oh shit, you know, young man, Canadian police uniform, was shot probably around 5 o'clock in and around Covent Garden in the left arm. He put them all together and basically just went to the police, said, oh, I think it is my mate. And it was 9:30 a.m. that morning. Police arrived, knocked on the room. James and Irene were in bed. What else was there? Detective Inspector Capstick said, I am a police inspector. I suspect you of murdering a barman at the Coach and Horses public house shortly after 5 a.m. He was cautioned. James said, I will tell you all about it. What else is there that I can tell you? He hadn't really got much on him, to be honest. He'd got obviously he's got his uniform, he got his gun, his arm was bandaged. He hadn't got his gun ammunition with him because he left it back at his billets. He got a bloodstained napkin on him where he tried to mop up some of his own blood. He got 1 shilling in silver and 4.5 pence in bronze. That's all the money he had left. He was taken to Bow Street Police Station, which is also a police court as well. And he said, I don't know how it happened.
I did not willfully murder him. But on the 27th of December, he was charged with murder. Murder. What else do we have on this list of things that I can tell you? No. I've put a lot of, repeated a lot of things to myself to make sure that I don't miss them. As mentioned, he was held in Brixton Prison. Many people are held in Brixton Prison because it's kind of like a holding point ready before they go to court. He was assessed by the doctor, who said he was medically fit, no history of mental illness, fits epilepsy. He obviously had pneumonia. They looked into all his past to do with illnesses in the past. They didn't really put all that together. What else has he got? He was examined by Colonel Hill, who was the Canadian Army neurologist at the time, and said that, you know, he was fine, suffering a little bit of trauma, but nothing major. And that's it. That's it, I think. Yeah, I think that's it. I think that's everything. I don't want to ruin the questions, which I've probably ruined a lot already anyway, haven't I? So let's go back. Let's go back to the questions. Right, get yourself ready. Get your tea ready. Get your cake ready. We're going to do the questions. Where are they? Here they are. Okay. Oh. Fresh cup of tea. Right, question one. What were the five alibis of James McCallum? They were money, drink, illness, trauma, and love. There you go. Question two. Which room did James stay in at the Trafalgar Hotel? I think I managed to not give it away on the things I've just said. That was room six. It looks like it's quite a nice posh hotel. When you go there, I've got a picture of it, and you go, "Ooh, that looks really nice." But obviously, wartime, you know, around this, a lot of these places around here were a bit crappy, and a lot of them were kind of, what's the word? Not enlisted. Kind of the government had said, "Okay, look, we need these kind of places for kind of troops." So, you know, a lot of them were quite a shabby state. Question three. What did James's dad do as a job? He was a steel riveter in the Clyde dockyard, apparently. Question four. What crime was James previously convicted of? The answer was none. He wasn't. He had no prior convictions. Question five. What was the name of Morris's wife and brother? Obviously, they're different people. It's not the same person. Unless he's from Norfolk. His wife's name was Dolly. Real name Dorothy. And his brother's name was David. Question six. What type of gun did James carry? Same gun as last week's episode. It was a .455 caliber Smith & Wesson Army issue revolver. Every time I write that down, I always deliberately write Smith & Wesson. And I always say to myself, make sure you don't say Smith & Western, as everyone says, which is a mistake. Everyone makes the same mistake. It's Smith & Wesson, W-E-S-S-O-N. And every week I listen back. I go, I've said Western again. Oh, let's hope I get it right this week. Question seven. What was James's military rank when he was arrested? When he was arrested, he'd been demoted back down to Lance Corporal. But he had previously been promoted to Acting Corporal. So he was actually Lance Corporal. Question eight. What job did Irene do? She was a waitress. Question nine. Where did they get engaged? It was in the shadow of Trafalgar Square. So I'm looking at cake. Question 10. Which building was blown up in Soho as witnessed by James? It was 24 Greek Street, which is currently a Moroccan restaurant called Touareg.
There is another murder there about 100 years ago. I think it's a 24 Greek Street as well. It was one of those cases that I'd never brought to Murder Mile, and when I went through it, it was one of those ones where it's just some men in a pub and they have some drinks and they have an argument over a girl and a bit of money and they have a fight and one of them hits their head on the pavement, and the amount of times I've gone through cases and gone, I hope this is interesting at the end. My note to myself is just don't bother with it. It's just bellends. It's just utter bellends who don't know how to get through life without going, oh, I need to hit someone. I'm a fucking idiot. I am. Look at me. I'm a moron. Oh, any episodes with bellends, I just instantly go, right, sod this. Can't be arsed. So that was the episode. Oh, God, that was a long extra mile. Shit. Right, I'm going to wrap this up. Hope you're all good. Hope you're all well. Stay safe. Be good. Eat lots of cake. Drink tea. Stay healthy. All good. Speak to you all again soon. Bye.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.